Would you consider giving £1,000 to Bristol?
£1,000 straight off the bat, just in 10 minutes between us, seems a little bit steep.
At a conference centre in England's second city, Birmingham, a university fundraiser has plucked up courage to ask a wealthy donor for a large sum of money. I'm Rob Broomby, and in this part two of Influence by Degree, we're looking at how universities raise money. It's a world of chiselled smiles and polished patter. With governments in many developed countries now less willing to pay for higher education, the institutions are being encouraged to raise more cash like this from benefactors. It's led them to choose some odd bedfellows.
You know, a member of my own profession wrote, "The Rupert Murdoch Professor of Language and Communication is like the Robert Mugabe Professor of Electoral Politics."
In the first programme of this BBC series, we saw how North America has refined the art of fundraising. This week, as Europe tries to catch up, we ask whether private money is stoking a series of intellectual proxy wars. But first to Birmingham, where another university fundraiser is begging for money from a man of means.
The Vice-Chancellor wants to talk to you about this project.
Oh, really? Right.
So what we're looking at is an investment of about £100,000 a year over 5 years.
OK, well, next week could be an interesting meeting.
The meeting is not quite what it appears. It's actually a role-play exercise. The applause was from an audience of fundraisers who are learning how to tease and cajole money from the rich. The conference is run by a not-for-profit organisation called CASE, which is helping to bring US-style fundraising techniques to European universities. Fundraisers say to succeed, you must understand a potential donor's motivation and whether they think they're rich enough to give. Tanya Jane Rawlinson raises money for Bristol University.
Rich is an interesting term. What is rich to me and to you is very different from what is rich to somebody who has a job in the city, is perhaps different again for somebody who is, say, a lawyer, who to you and me seems exceptionally well paid, a QC who's earning £1 million a year. But that QC who's earning £1 million a year is probably earning that while working for people who earn £5 or £10 million a year. So does that QC feel rich earning £1 million a year? Not necessarily.
Tanya Jane Rawlinson is careful not to mention the amount she's after, at least at the beginning. It's all about timing.
It feels a little bit like the way in which a very talented fisherman or woman would talk about hauling in a very large salmon. I mean, there's something of that in this, isn't there?
When I'm talking with them, I'm not usually, when we're talking about a significant gift, talking about the quantum in the first instance. You end up talking about what you hope their gift will achieve. Something at Bristol that we're trying to do right now is to build a laboratory for somebody who's using stem cells to stop babies from needing multiple open heart surgeries when they're born with a hole in the heart. That is a moving, powerful story. How much is that laboratory going to cost is almost incidental until the point when I make the ask.
Universities are getting better at making the ask, knowing when to raise the vulgar issue of money. The latest figures for Britain in 2010-11 show that British universities raised $900 million from benefactors, still only a tiny fraction of total revenue, but increasing dramatically. Rory Brooks is a major donor to Manchester University. He was the first in his family to reach higher education. He says it changed his life. He's primed to give.
Family and education are two of the absolute cornerstones of most people's lives and set them on the path that they end up on. So I think that giving back to the part of life that made you seems fairly natural.
Are you one of those who is a repeat giver? And if so, how much have you contributed over the years?
I am a repeat giver, and I think it's a matter of Manchester University's public record that we're up to about £4 million now.
From you personally?
Yes, from the foundation that my wife and I have established. And we've just announced the fact that we're about to go into another three-year programme for extending that gift.
And what do you feel you get back for that? Is there any kind of reward for you?
No, there is no tangible reward at all. It's neither offered nor asked for.
Rory Brooks is paying specifically for research into global poverty. His money does not go into a general pot. Most donors do want a say in how their money is broadly spent. Getting cash with no strings attached is rare. But is the dash for cash, as we heard in Programme 1, distorting the academic agenda?
This is Sussex University, which sits amidst the green rolling hills near the south coast of England. It opened in the 1960s, when government funding for universities was generous. Now it's adapting to more commercial times. This gleaming new building houses the School of Business, Management and Economics. Critics say it's part of a strategy to refocus the university on areas that will earn money. From a turnover of around $290 million, Sussex currently raises less than $9 million privately. Sussex University Vice-Chancellor Michael Farthing says they're looking for more.
We want to grow our philanthropic income, but it was not many years ago when our annual income was probably a million or even less in some years.
Is it something you embrace and think is a good thing for education?
I think it's a good thing. And I do embrace it. And to be absolutely frank, I enjoy the process. One of the things I've learnt about philanthropy is that philanthropists actually really enjoy giving away money. And it's more than the money. The relationships you form with a philanthropist are enduring, they're quite profound on occasions, and a huge level of trust and mutual support develops.
The veteran publisher Lord Weidenfeld fled to the UK from his native Austria when it was annexed by Nazi Germany. He's one of those putting up the money for a series of chairs in Israeli studies, including a post at Sussex. So why did he do it?
Registered for two reasons. One, for purely academic reasons, also partly because of the increasing hostility to Israel on the campuses in this country. I thought, no better way of producing, of putting across, projecting the image of Israel was to have a university chair, to be also a rallying point for information to fight against the strong, concentrated anti-Israel campaigns on British universities.
So you thought this could be an answer to that, a help with that debate?
A useful, dignified academic answer, yes.
You said that there was a perceived anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism in many university departments.
Yes.
Would you see this professor getting directly involved in those debates and arguments?
This is not the main reason for having him there, but I expect him to have a positive attitude to his subject.
Will you get a say in who it is?
Of course not.
What would happen if the academics there chose somebody for one of these chairs who you found unacceptable? Perhaps was overly critical of, say, Israel's role in the occupied territories or any aspect of current Israeli policy. What would you do then?
It would be bad luck.
You'd just wash your hands and walk away, or
well,
what?
We would go to a university where we believe that, by and large, the people in charge are people of integrity.
Back at Sussex, Lord Weidenfeld's words came as a shock. Academics feared their cherished freedoms were at stake and that the chair might be used to gloss Israel's image. Dr. Jan Selby, a senior lecturer in international relations at Sussex, spoke for many.
The central two concerns that I have are, firstly, that this is clearly based on a donation which has been given to Sussex as part of a political agenda. A quite naked political agenda. I think it's important to recognise that this donation is not a philanthropic donation, it's a political donation.
Because you feel they have a specific outcome that they want to see from the work of that chair? Is that what you're suggesting?
Absolutely. Lord Weidenfeld, he said that the funded chair at Sussex, as well as at Oxford and plans for other institutions, are part of, quote, the fight against anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. Behind and beyond that are a set of concerns about Israel specifically and about the university having a chair which has been funded with the intention of casting a positive light on what is, to put it bluntly, an apartheid state.
A contentious view. Also contentious is Lord Weidenfeld's claims that it's evidence of what he sees as a deeper prejudice in British universities, which he thinks needs to be confronted.
the whole thing is typical of a very anti-Israeli stand. The implication is there is some sinister thing behind the scenes to infiltrate the university and so on, when in fact it is purely defensive.
So is the job then to improve the image of Israel around Britain, but around the world,
of
essentially?
Of course, there's nothing wrong with that.
Despite the concerns of staff, Michael Farthing, the Vice-Chancellor of Sussex University, was unperturbed.
I think universities should be in the centre of controversy. Universities provide the evidence, provide the, if you like, the safe haven for difficult discussions.
But the fear is that the post may become very ideological. And when we spoke to Lord Weidenfeld and asked him why he thought it was worth putting the money in, he came up with some interesting quotes. He said it was to be a rallying point for information to fight against the strong, concentrated anti-Israeli campaigns on British universities. That sounds like somebody with a point to make.
Yes, I mean, that clearly is Lord Weidenfeld's view. It's not my view. I'm interested in looking at evidence. I'm interested in reflecting on history. I'm interested in accurate information. And I'm interested in dialogue.
But you can see how people on this university campus and elsewhere become concerned that these donors could want to influence the agenda in some way, to get involved in a very political debate that's going on out there in the wider world.
Yes, but I think it's our responsibility to resist that. What I like is that we should be at the centre of controversy, but it should be balanced, it should be run in the way in which we run all academic programmes, in an intelligent, intellectual way.
So the cash is flowing, but the price could be a divided faculty and campus, with some arguing the university's reputation is being corroded. The professor of Israeli studies at Sussex was due to start in mid-October. Almost a month later, and no one has been appointed. Lord Weidenfeld, meanwhile, insists that the chairs of Israeli studies are needed to combat the influence of Arab money.
You've mentioned Arab money a few times. Are there university departments that cause you particular concern that we ought to be looking at in terms of that money?
Well, you'll go to Exeter.
We took his advice. Here at Exeter University in the southwest of England, the signs of investment and modernisation are everywhere, despite a dramatic decline in government funding. The gaps have been filled by private gifts, the bigger donations coming from rich Gulf nations. Lord Weidenfeld claims that has helped nurture an anti-Israeli bias. So does the Arab money talk?
I haven't noticed any influence.
Professor Ilan Pape is the man Lord Weidenfeld has in his sights. He's an Israeli himself, but an outspoken critic of the Israeli state, and he's director of the European Centre for Palestinian Studies. It sits within an institution funded by the ruler of Sharjah, one of the United Arab Emirates.
Is this an institution which is biased against Israel, would you say?
First of all, I'm very flattered that all the Centers for Israel Studies were built in order to counter me. No, I don't think the Institute has a policy. I think people like Weidenfeld don't understand what universities are and what they are supposed to be. Universities come from the word universal. They host people with different views and different ideas. And these individuals are totally by themselves when it comes to pronouncing a political opinion.
But your position fits perfectly, doesn't it, with the worldview of the Arabic world, although you're yourself an Israeli who's critical of that state?
Not at all. Not at all. I criticize very strongly the passivity and lack of action on behalf of Arab regimes. I don't think they like what I write. You know, my books have been censored in Jordan and in other Arab countries.
Does it not, though, help them raise money here for the university in the Arabic world to show that they've got someone like you who's such an outspoken critic of the Israeli government?
On the contrary. I think it undermines a little bit their ability because I'm a troublemaker which the Gulf states don't like.
Exeter University said in a written response that they didn't think Ilan Pape's views had any great effect on fundraising from the Arab world, negative or otherwise. Ilan Pape says there was never a golden age. When governments paid more for education, they also wanted influence. Still, he appears to relish the idea of locking horns with Lord Weidenfeld and his Israeli studies departments.
OK, fair enough. But it's an interesting question. Why are so many centres for one little country. I mean, after all, this is Islam is one-third of the world population.
If I can categorise your position as I understand it at the moment, you seem to be saying, bring it on.
Bring it on if he wants to, but it's ridiculous. Don't you think it's ridiculous?
Universities thrive on argument and cloistered rivalries. It's what they do. But if those rivalries are stoked by outsiders offering large gifts, will the spires of the academic world tilt towards the money? This is Oxford, the city of the gleaming spires itself, and home to one of the world's most prestigious universities, where the courtship between wealthy benefactors and cash-hungry colleges has led to some dangerous liaisons. Now, bear with me. First, let's take a look at some of today's headlines from the Sun newspaper. We have Adele in rage at sexy vids. Simon Cowell sizzles on dates with busty blonde. Now, why am I quoting Britain's most brazen tabloid newspaper in the middle of Worcester College, Oxford? Simple. The Sun's owner, Rupert Murdoch, pays for the chair here in language and communication. As the Sun might say, gotcha.
I'd be very surprised if Rupert Murdoch had ever read a single word I wrote.
Deborah Cameron is that professor, and when one of Murdoch's newspapers, the News of the World, was alleged to have engaged in illegal phone hacking, she, an academic, remember, was an easy target for the media magnate's critics.
It mostly took the form of kind of snide comments. Somebody wrote, the Rupert Murdoch Professor of Language and Communication is like the Robert Mugabe Professor of Electoral Politics.
She briefly considered resigning, and she says she's no fan of Murdoch's products. But what she offers us is a glimpse of that uncomfortable relationship between wealthy donors and the universities who want their cash. She's coined a rather arresting phrase for the way money distorts a university's work.
All fur coat and no knickers. You know, that many donors are more interested in paying for, if you like, frills, fur coats, rather than your basic contents of your underwear drawer. The humdrum everyday teaching and acquisition of books and paying of the people who are there already.
She says she felt under an obligation to maintain a cordial relationship with Murdoch's companies. The reason why the university would want that is clear.
If you keep donors happy, they might be persuaded to give again. And also, if you're seen to keep your donors happy, new donors will come.
It's a slippery slope, that, isn't it?
Well, I think it indicates that what we often call philanthropy does actually have at least a tinge of a relationship for which a better word might be patronage. That they are courted and perhaps they expect to be courted.
Does that feel uncomfortable for yourself as an academic?
Yes, sometimes it does. I think there is a certain obsequiousness about it.
Before the phone hacking scandal, she attended two News International summer parties, and she's briefly met both Rupert Murdoch and his son James. There was no firewall between the benefactor and recipient. Earlier this year, Rupert Murdoch was grilled by a parliamentary committee about the phone hacking scandal.
There was no attempt, either at my level or several levels below me, to cover it up.
There are you with a chair in language and communication which bears the Murdoch name at a time when that's highly controversial.
It's not an easy position to be in.
But as I say, we've had a parliamentary committee reach its own verdict on Rupert Murdoch, said he wasn't a fit person to run an international organisation.
Yes. So then, I mean, you're broaching the question, though, that does that also mean he's not a fit person to give money to a university?
And what do you think?
No comment.
In a statement, Oxford University told us there was no obligation on people whose posts are funded by philanthropy to regularly engage with the donor. Back at the fundraisers conference in Birmingham, it's clear the university sector has embraced fundraising with gusto. The talk amongst the euphemistically named development managers is of exponential growth in their sector. It's less than a year since the London School of Economics was in crisis after accepting money from a foundation run by Colonel Gaddafi's son. That scandal tarnished the university's reputation. But already, the message to fundraisers here is get out and raise money and don't be too risk-averse.
Well, I think it's terribly important that we don't let that incident make us too cautious.
Shirley Pierce has just chaired a review of philanthropy for HEFCE, the organisation which allots UK government money to universities. But only one of its 14 recommendations deals with the reputational risk.
We have to make sure we've got risk management procedures in place. And universities take risks all the time.
That does seem strange language. So soon after a major crisis in Britain's university sector, it seems strange that people are already talking about there being too much risk aversion rather than perhaps we should be a little bit more cautious in the years ahead.
Oh, I think people have said let's make sure we've got the right processes in place, and it was a lesson and an interesting example of what can go wrong. I think each institution has looked at how would it be that we could avoid that thing happening to us.
But the man who wrote the last major report into university philanthropy, Professor Eric Thomas, Vice-Chancellor of Bristol University, was more candid.
In fact, the overwhelming majority of the donations that are being made are entirely kosher, above board, no problem at all. By definition, there is always going to be a risk that a donation will bite you. Yesterday's friend, it's very interesting how it becomes today's enemy. I'm not denying that there will not be gifts from individuals who at the time appear to be perfectly above board, who in 5 years' time it's found actually they were not above board at all. The question is, we don't live in a risk-free world. The only answer to that is to ask nobody for money. That's not an option. So we will have to take the risk, but we'll have to do as good due diligence as we possibly can.
Back at Oxford University, Professor Cameron has seen her sponsor pilloried. She's endured calls for her to stand down. To her, the risks are very real.
I think if you really applied a very high ethical standard, you wouldn't have too many donors, because I don't think anybody gets that rich enough to drop a few million without in their life having perhaps cut the odd corner or had the odd controversial dealing. There is always now the possibility that some skeleton will come rattling out of the closet and your acceptance of a donation will come back to bite you.
So there are accidents waiting to happen out there even now?
Oh, I think there must be thousands of accidents waiting to happen.
So even if big spending philanthropists can be tapped for cash and then kept from interfering until the next funding round, the things they choose to lavish their money on will in the end alter European universities dramatically. As private funding increases, not just in Europe but around the world, the pet projects of wealthy donors will flourish, and less glamorous subjects may well struggle. Universities will inevitably bow towards private money. You've been listening to me, Rob Broomby. The programme producer was David Edmonds.